This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
What the hell is the matter with you people? You've caused more damage than that goddamn thing did!
All right, Mayor, calm down. Just have some candy.
No, I don't want any candy. Leave me alone.
Welcome, everybody, back to Cinematic Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today, we've got a bit of a unique episode. I am not joined by Adam or Dave. We are going to look at some common scientific tropes in the context of the new and old American Godzilla films. So Godzilla 98 and the new legendary films. And we're going to kind of compare them bit by bit. But before we get into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm a freshwater ecologist at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Also run the website Ecology for the Masses. Now, like I said, Adam and Dave are not with me today. Instead, I'm joined by Travis Alexander from the Kaiju Weekly podcast.
Hello.
How's it going?
It's going good. It's going good. I'm glad to be here. I've been a fan of your podcast for a while.
Yeah, this is the first crossover we've done with another podcast on this one, actually. I've been on Kaiju Weekly a couple of times, but this is the first guest we've had from another podcast, so...
Well, I'm really honored.
Why don't you tell people a little bit about what Kaiju Weekly is?
Well, Kaiju Weekly is a weekly podcast that introduces people to the wide world of giant monster movies. We are fans of giant monster movies, me and my co-host Michael, and we review the movies, we talk about them. We embrace the sillier side of giant monster movies, but we also like to extol the legitimately good movies that are out there in the genre.
What would you recommend as your kind of intro to your podcast, a good kind of jumping off episode?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, you can always start with the most recent one. As of right now, the most recent episode we put out was King Kong Escapes, which was the Japanese production, or it was a co-production with an American company of a King Kong movie where King Kong fights Mechanikong, which is a robot version of King Kong, and it is so much fun and I loved it.
There's a Gorosaurus in there as well, like just a regular dinosaur.
Yep, just a regular dinosaur.
Yeah.
Yep, it's a good one.
Thundering 60-foot robot Kong of Steel, creation of the evil Dr. Who, criminal genius who stops at nothing. Kong, once again, dig!
We are going to, like I said, look at the 98 Godzilla, let's say, not iconic, but infamous, perhaps?
Yeah.
The infamous first American attempt at recreating Godzilla. And we're also going to look at the more recent Godzilla films, which I think we can say from both the fans and the general public have been much better received.
Oh, yeah.
Than the initial one.
There are fans of the G98, the Godzilla 1998 movie out there. And one thing about me since doing Kaiju Weekly, because I grew up in an area where there wasn't a lot of fellow Kaiju fans. Me and my dad were the only ones that I knew of. But since growing up and now getting into the podcasting game, I've connected with so many other people who are fans and part of the community, and I found out that, the Godzilla 98 is not as hated by everyone as I initially thought. Now, there's still plenty of people out there who hate it, and some for very good reasons, but yeah. there are some G98 supporters, so... just wanted to give them a shout out too.
Yeah.
Watch as Dean Devlin and Roland Emmerich transform the most iconic movie monster of all time into a box-headed, chicken leg, no atomic breath having Jay Leno chin, stupid faced, flat nosed piece of shit. God, I hate this movie.
Well, we'll get into our personal kind of opinions on that movie a little later, because, like I said, we're going to do a bit of a comparison of some things like their representation of scientists, how enjoyable it is, how realistic it is. I think we're coming at this from two very different perspectives. You as the big kaiju fan and me as the pedantic asshole who likes to pick holes in movies. But what I thought we could do first is, as kind of an introduction to Godzilla and his, let's say, ilk, I wanted you to maybe take us through what a kaiju actually is.
Well, in the loosest definition of it, it is a giant monster. That is generally the term that most people accept, or the definition that most people accept nowadays is giant monster. But in Japanese, the word kaiju actually literally means strange beast. So it's a word that's used in a lot of different contexts. And just like in English, we have words for like monster, creature, thing. They have that same thing in Japan. Most people will tell you that kaiju should only refer to monsters from Japan. Me personally, I don't ascribe to that because then that takes out a lot of monsters that I consider kaiju, like King Kong, as an example. I consider him a kaiju. He's an American monster. Then you have the question of, well, what about Yangari, which is a Korean monster, but was made with the help of some Japanese filmmakers. And so it there's so many gray areas that for me personally, I like to just use the term as giant monster of some kind.
Okay. All right. Well, look, what I did before the show is get together with Dave and Adam on Messenger and put together a bit of a list that we want to just throw at you really quickly.
Okay.
So kaiju or not kaiju?
Okay.
Okay. First one. Have you seen the black and white classic Them back in the day?
Yes, I have.
Huge ants, for anyone who doesn't...
Right, yeah. It's giant ants. I consider them kaiju. Now, again, we talked about this when you guessed it on my podcast. I have a looser definition of kaiju than some people do, because I consider Killer Tomatoes, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, a kaiju film, and it's like, that might be pushing the definition a little too hard.
Okay. Well, let's see how hard we can push the definition. I've got another ant-based one. Have you seen Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Now, the ants in that are not technically big, but from the context of... would you consider that an element of kaiju in a movie?
That is a good one, because that one is kind of... You know, it's on the line. They are kind of like giant monsters, especially the scorpion in that movie is really, really monstrous in that.
There's a scorpion in that movie?
Yeah, that's the, spoiler alert to anybody who hasn't seen it.
Okay.
The ant is actually friendly to the kids who are shrunk, and the ant actually dies defending the kids from the scorpion.
Right. Now, taking the reverse of that. The baby from Honey, I Blew Up the Kid.
Oh, that one I definitely consider a kaiju.
Okay.
Because anybody who, you know, anybody who has kids or has been around kids who are at that age, they know those things are little monsters.
Mindless monsters causing wanton destruction. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so easy one then. Cloverfield, the Cloverfield monster.
It's definitely kaiju. It's what most... If you want to be super specific, I think the term they use for foreign kaiju in Japan is kaijin, because it's an American monster, not from Japan, but as a general term, it's kaiju.
Okay. The Iron Giant.
Now, that one, here's the thing. There's another podcast that's in the that does giant monster movie reviews called Gargantucast, and they do a segment called Is It Kaiju? At the end of each episode. And one thing that they like to talk about when they're doing their segment is if it's too anthropomorphized, if it has too much of a personality, does that eliminate the idea of it being a monster? Does it now become an individual, a person? You know, Smaug is a good example of that. Smaug can talk, can think independently. He does monstrous things. So, to me, the Iron Giant kind of pushes past the idea of a monster and becomes more like an individual person, because he can speak, he can think, he can, you know, and stuff. But then again, he does some very kaiju-like things in that movie.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, well, how about Vin Diesel then?
Oh, man. Vin Diesel.
Because, I mean, speaking, thinking, not so much. Like,
yeah, not so much. I would put The Rock as a kaiju before I would put Vin Diesel.
Yes, good point.
It became clear The Rock was referencing Vin Diesel in his scathing statement.
It wasn't that hard to find you, Toretto.
Wasn't hiding.
The pair reportedly met to try and resolve their differences in a big guy powwow. But according to TMZ, the chat didn't go well. They both have egos that are even larger than their biceps.
So, we've gone through a bunch of different kaiju, but none I feel anywhere near as enduring as Godzilla. So maybe before we start to get stuck into the films, take us through what makes Godzilla so enduring. Because you were saying he certainly wasn't the first giant monster.
Yeah, he definitely wasn't. I mean, giant monsters have existed in different cultures for thousands of years. The idea of a giant monster is nothing new. But even in film, you know, King Kong in 1933 was a giant monster, and then the movie that directly inspired Godzilla was Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Now, the thing that I think separates Godzilla from giant monsters that came before him was that he reached people in a way that no other monster did before.
Yeah.
Because this was a time period in Japan that, you know, it was less than 10 years after the war ended, and it was a very rough time for the world in general. Japanese, you know, specifically, but for the world in general, there's a lot of anxiety on what's going to happen to the world now that the war has ended. Now the Cold War is kicking off between America and the Soviet Union, and here comes this giant monster movie that takes all of those anxieties about nuclear radiation and about, you know, destructions of cities and things like that. And it just goes at it in such a way that it connected with people. They really felt that anxiety. The director, Ishiro Honda, was so good at capturing just the feelings of people. And Godzilla became a tragic character. Like, he is a monster, but if you watch that movie, Godzilla is a tragic character because he was not trying to destroy, or he was destroying cities, but he was a victim of the, you know, atomic bomb testing and everything, just like everybody else was. So that kind of is what I think made Godzilla so memorable. But then what made him stick around was this idea that he could change, because if you know anything about Godzilla history, Godzilla became a hero monster to where he was protecting the Earth from other more dangerous monsters. And so I think the idea that Godzilla can adapt and change with the changing times is really what gave him his staying power.
Cool, yeah, and I mean, because he's had a lot of different faces. Like, we talked about this ourselves in our last Godzilla episode, the fact that they've kind of renewed him with the time. So, for instance, Shin Godzilla, which came out back in 2016, that was kind of a reintroduction of the character, and they had those same themes as well, whereas the first Godzilla was, the dangers of atomic testing. I think Shin Godzilla, a lot of what inspired that was the huge environmental disaster that happened.
Yeah, the Fukushima.
Yeah, the Fukushima plant, it was a nuclear power plant collapse, right, as a result of the earthquake.
Yeah, it was an earthquake that caused a tsunami that caused a nuclear meltdown at a power plant. So yeah, it was a really, really terrible disaster. But yeah, Godzilla has changed over time. Like I said, he went from being a tragic monster figure that caused a lot of destruction and death to being a hero, and actually very kid-friendly hero too, because there a lot of the later movies in of the like 70s and late 60s and 70s, they became very kid-friendly.
Yeah, and you can see it with the design too. The eyes get a little bigger. They're very much kind of forward-facing. It's a much more kind of appealing, less reptilian face, I would say.
Yeah, definitely.
They even introduced his Godzuki, his little kid.
Yeah, now Godzuki, Godzuki is only from the cartoon.
Okay.
The one you might be thinking of is Manila.
Oh, right. Yep. Yeah.
But yeah, they introduced Son of Godzilla and thinking of Godzuki for anyone who might be listening to your podcast who's not familiar with Kaiju Weekly. We like to embrace the silly side of kaiju movies on Kaiju Weekly, and so we rate our movies out of 5 Godzukis. Godzilla, Godzilla, and Godzilla.
Okay, so let's get stuck into the movies we're looking at today, which well, 3 movies in total, but 2 separate baskets. So the first one is Godzilla 1998. Mm-hmm. Now, I remember I didn't go and see this at the movies, but I remember we got it on VHS pretty soon after it came out at the store, mm-hmm. and I loved this film when I saw it. My parents, this is before, you know, that age before you realize that movies can be terrible.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that this was before that for me. And I love Jurassic Park. I love big monsters at that age. I was, you know, keen to be a paleontologist or a marine biologist, one of the two. And I love this movie. I went back and watched it when I was, I think, when I went through my big old Godzilla movie phase when I was like 21, 22. And, oh boy, it had not aged well. And we talked about the fact that there are fans of this movie.
Right.
Would you count yourself amongst one of them?
When I was younger, because I had been a Godzilla, I've been a Godzilla fan since before I can remember.
You were saying your dad was a big kaiju fan as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. I always say I inherited my Godzilla fandom. So I was already, at the time, I was 8 or 9 years old when this movie came out. And I was already a huge Godzilla fan, so excited, get to see an American-made Godzilla film, go to the theater, and I cried during it because it was not Godzilla.
Oh, right, okay.
It was not Godzilla, it was not my Godzilla, and so that kind of, you know, made me upset.
Yeah.
Looking back on it now and watching it now, I appreciate it as a giant monster movie that just happens to have a name Godzilla, and yeah. That's why I like to refer to it as Geno. That's a kind of a common term for fans in the Godzilla community. It's Geno is short for Godzilla in name only, because there's nothing else that connects it to Godzilla. It is just the name, and yeah. So if you take away the name Godzilla, it's no worse than some of the other giant monster movies that are out there. So for me, I have learned over time to kind of put aside my prejudice of this is not my Godzilla and just kind of appreciate it as a silly, dumb, giant monster movie.
So you think it's just the fact that it's Godzilla? I hate all the characters in it. I think it's kind of funny watching Jean Reno just be the Frenchiest French guy ever.
Oh, Jean Reno, yeah.
Like just complaining about the baguettes and the coffee and the the French roast and that sort of stuff.
He is so great.
There's kind of a little bit of when they first come on, and if you're a bit, I didn't get this when I first watched it, but when I went back and watched it after I'd come to appreciate kind of movie culture a bit more, the Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel send up,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of funny, but they also don't really do anything with them.
Yeah, Roger Ebert, famously, when he reviewed this G98. He said, talking to Roland Emmerich, the director, said, you went so far as to put me and Siskel in the movie and you didn't even have the decency to kill us.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that would have been, maybe he thought that was too over the top.
Maybe.
I don't know. But
Roland Emmerich has never in his life said, oh, I think that's a little too over the top.
Yeah, he's not a man of subtlety, is he? Yeah. For those who don't know, Roland Emmerich is he... kind of made his name doing these enormous, like, big-budget disaster movies. Like, was he The Day After Tomorrow? Who was The Day After Tomorrow?
Day After Tomorrow and Independence Day are probably his two, next to G98, his two big known movies.
Yeah. Looking back on it, because Independence Day is, I still think it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is better, G98 or Independence Day?
I think Independence Day is better. But I think it comes down to the charisma of the actors.
Yeah, you've got much less irritating actors in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, you've got
Jeff Goldblum reprising his exact character from Jurassic Park.
Exactly, and Will Smith, of course, Will Smith being Will Smith. It's like you've got such a even the minor characters like Judd Hirsch, you've got Brent Spiner from Star Trek is in it. It's so good. There's so many memorable and great characters there. But G98, all of the characters and some of the actors are really good. I think Matthew Broderick is a decent actor, but just something about this film, they're lifeless. Other than Jean Reno.
Yes, I did not care for the plethora of Simpsons characters.
Yeah, Hank Azaria, I mean, he's memorable, but is he memorable for the right reasons? I don't know.
No, I don't think so. But yeah, it's just they're very irritating characters, I think. And I think it's also that, look, there was a little too much kind of, hey, we've seen Jurassic World and we kind of want to do that.
Yeah, well, that's the thing you were talking about, how you were a fan of Jurassic Park as a kid.
Time, yeah.
And so it makes sense that if you're not someone who grew up with Godzilla and you watch this movie and you already like Jurassic Park, why you might like this movie as a kid, because this is more like Jurassic Park than Godzilla.
Yeah. Surprisingly enough, though, I showed this one to my kid about 6 months ago, thinking, oh, he'll enjoy this. Hated it. Got so bored.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, prefer the new ones, yeah?
That's boring. You're boring, everybody. Quit boring, everyone.
Anyway, yeah, let's move on to the new ones. So we had Godzilla, which came out in 2014, which introduced some new Mutos kind of as his foil. And this was very much back to the Godzilla as the protector. Kind of thing. He's fending off these animals. I like this film. I liked it when I saw it. It really gave me tingles to see the atomic breath done justice in in an American film.
I clapped, the whole theater clapped. It was fantastic.
It's a great moment. And I think it was just one of the most fun moments of cinema for that whole year. The ending where he's just, you know, rips the Muto's head off and breathes the atomic fire straight down his neck. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
And look, it's the classic criticism that's made of these films. Why would you have Bryan Cranston, who was flying high at the time, really like his peak of coming off Breaking Bad and all that sort of stuff, and a very charismatic character as well, and then they kill him off after, what, 40, 45 minutes?
Yeah, it wasn't even halfway through the whole movie.
Yeah.
The thing about that, and I'll refer to another movie when talking about Godzilla 2014 and that specifically, Iron Man 3.
Yes.
Most people don't like Iron Man 3, and a big point of contention in that movie is the fact that the Mandarin, the main villain of that, turns out to be some dumb actor and he's not real. Now, that twist in itself is not a bad idea. It's the execution and what they followed it up with. And I think that same problem is in G14, which is you have Bryan Cranston, who's this, you know, great character. He's a tragic character. He has a lot of bones to pick with people.
Yeah.
And you kill him off. That idea is not a bad idea. It's what you replace him with and what you follow that up with. It better be good, because you're killing off the most interesting character. So the character you replace him with better be more interesting than what you just got rid of. And it just wasn't.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely wasn't.
I think Elizabeth Olsen can be a great actress. But Aaron Taylor-Johnson, I don't mind him. I think he was kind of fun in Kick-Ass before this, but he is just a charisma vacuum in this film.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah, it's
and the scientists aren't particularly engaging at all. I don't know. But look, like I said, the little bit of Godzilla we do get was fantastic, and I really enjoyed that. It gets all the science stuff. It never bothers me too much when I'm watching the films. It's only when I kind of think of it afterwards. But all that stuff gets way worse in the second film. So moving on to from Godzilla 2014 to the more recent one, Godzilla King of the Monsters, which came out last year, where they really went kind of full Godzilla. They got Rodan, they got Mothra, they got King Ghidorah. They created some new kaiju as well, brought some old ones back, but they really went for it. Now, we've talked about this before, that if you just want kind of a normal movie with, you know, normal structure and plot and that sort of stuff, it's ridiculous. But as a Godzilla film, it's great fun.
Oh, yeah. And I think that there are a lot of people in the Godzilla community that do have their own issues with King of the Monsters. So I won't go as far as say everyone who loves Godzilla will love this movie.
Yeah.
It's not a masterpiece. It's not Citizen Kane by any stretch.
Yeah.
But as just a fun Godzilla movie, if you are a fan of the what's known as the Heisei period of Godzilla, which was like the late 80s and 90s period of Godzilla films, it fits right in with everything that was done in that era of Godzilla films. So I can see why people might have a problem with it, because it doesn't really have that deep emotional impact that something like the original Gojira from 1954 might have. But it's a ton of fun, and if you just watch it and enjoy the fun in it.
Yeah, it's great fun. And if you're not a fan of Godzilla or just, you know, stupid monster movies in general, you're not going to like it, but I don't know. Look, these are both much better than Godzilla 98 in any case.
Yeah, I think the quality is better. As far as like characters, the writing, the monster itself, I think is better utilized in the new movies versus G98. Now, as far as the science side of it, you can go into that part.
Yeah.
Then we're going to use reductive amination to yield methamphetamine, 4 pounds.
So no pseudo.
No pseudo.
Yeah, Mr. White. Yes, science.
Okay.
Yeah, let's get stuck in now, because here at Cinematic Animalia, we're not movie reviewers. We don't give a shit if the movie's good or bad. How's the science? So we've got kind of 5 key themes we want to touch on today. Before we get stuck in, I should do the normal quick plug. If you wanna get in touch, if you've got thoughts about this episode or any other episode, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at @SamPerrinNTNU. Adam, one of my normal co-hosts, is Adam @HarsikAdam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, visit cinematicaanimalia.com. You can also email us with any questions, concerns, suggestions at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. And you can also hear about some of the more hardcore science that Adam and I write about at ecologyforthemasses.com. Trav, where can we find you?
You can find me at the Kaiju Weekly Podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever that you listen to your favorite podcasts. That's the best place, but you can also tweet at me at Kaiju Weekly on Twitter. I'm also on Instagram, Kaiju Weekly Pod.
Okay, now let's start with these 5 topics that I want to get in today. The first is the concept of environmental messaging in film. Now, they do this very differently over the 2 films. So kind of, I think where it starts and stops in Godzilla 98 is, hey, the French, we did a bunch of nuclear testing. Nuclear testing's bad. We're going to make up for our mistakes. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of, it's not too deep. It's very kind of surface level. It's not given much much screen time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they do mention how Godzilla was mutated from radiation. The reason why they bring Nick Titopoulos in is because he is doing studies on earthworms that have been mutated by the radiation around Chernobyl. So, you know, they do talk about that, but it's not a bash you over the head kind of environmental message.
Which you definitely get in the 2019 film. It is.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I mean, to be fair, it's not there too much in 2014. There's a lot of Ken Watanabe's kind of like, hey, these are the original owners. We need to return Earth to them and that sort of thing. But there is one scene in particular in Godzilla King of the Monsters where Vera Farmiga's character has set up this video that she's kind of got prepped beforehand. Yeah, it's like
a PowerPoint presentation.
Oh, my God. And it is just it's the pit. It's like a couple of minutes of her just talking about how we haven't been listening to reason. We haven't done anything. It's like, no, we know this is happening. Most authorities around the planet know this is happening. It's...
Yeah.
And she's also, she's talking to a room of scientists. Like, that
right.
Why are you preaching? You're preaching to the choir. And it's just...
Exactly. And I'm completely with you. In fact, her character in general was probably my least favorite part of that movie. The thing that gets me is exactly what you said. She's talking to Monarch. Monarch's entire MO is about studying these creatures and how they interact with the environment.
Yeah.
And she's talking to them about how these were the original rulers of the Earth and we should respect them. It's like, yeah, that's what we're doing.
When you're at, like, when I've been at science conferences before, you never get anyone going up there and saying, hey, there's always stuff about, hey, this is what we're doing to the planet, but it's never like bashing you over the head, because everybody in the room would just be immediately like, yeah, we fucking know, that's why we're here. Like,
yeah.
I mean, absolutely try to inspire some action, but that's not what she's doing. She's just, I don't know, maybe some of the military people benefited from it. I've got no idea, but it's really just a very ham-fisted attempt. And then towards the end, they've got those weird kind of things that roll over the credits as well. Which is like the monster waste replenishing the earth and forests springing up where they've been. I mean, the forests aren't springing up because of the Titans. It's because there's no one in those cities anymore. Like, it's... Oh,
yeah.
Dear.
Yeah, it's kind of like what we're seeing with this pandemic, you know, with people not out doing as much. Suddenly now animals are coming into areas where they haven't been for a while.
Yeah.
Well, it's not because the animals... It's not because of the pandemic itself. It's because people aren't there to stop the animals from doing these things.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I kind of, even though, like I said, we think it's the far worst film, I kind of have to give the point here to Godzilla 98, because it just, it's not a huge part of the film, doesn't beat you over the head with it. It's, yeah.
It's the single largest disaster in recorded history. It is worse than 50 Exxon Valdez spills.
You don't have to yell at us. Nobody is on the other side of this issue.
Now, let's move on to this concept of, Nick Tatopoulos, or Tatopoulos, or Tatopoulos, or however they decide to pronounce it for some really cheap, shitty joke. But in any case, the concept of him as the one guy that they bring in to solve all their problems. Do you ever at any point buy that he's this genius that they should have brought in?
Yeah, he definitely looks like the kind of person who might devote his life to studying the effects of radiation on earthworms. Yeah. But as far as being like an expert on everything else that he's an expert on, I don't necessarily buy him.
Yeah, no, I mean, and just this concept of the one man. So I had forgotten that they actually have two other characters. They've got the ginger lady, who is just blatantly hitting on him right for the start.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which, if the genders were reversed, I would say was pretty par for the course in science in the late 90s. It's interesting, but she is just right from the start. She's a creep. And then there's, I can't remember his name, but he's Sneeze Guy. When he meets Nick Tatopoulos, he's just like sneezes and offers him his hand. And look, it's definitely a product of the times we're living in right now. But when I saw that, I just had a really visceral reaction, like, oh, dude, get some anti back. Like, what are you doing?
Now, are you familiar at all with the cartoon series that spun off of this movie?
No, but I heard it did a lot more. It's about that Godzilla that hatches at the end, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's a continuation of it. And they don't bring any of the original cast back, but they do bring all the characters back. Animal is there, who's Hank Azaria's character. That redhead, played by Vicki Lewis, she's in the series. And so is that other scientist, Mr. Sneezy, is also there. And they're more interesting in the cartoon. The cartoon does everything way better than the movie did.
But I have to say that I buy the second lot of scientists. Not what they're spouting, because what they're spouting is rubbish. But the fact that you have like an interdisciplinary team there. Like, you rock up to the base and you've got scientists running everywhere. For something like this, I think that is a lot more realistic than just like three people working out the back of a truck. Do you buy this? Because this crops up a lot in movies. They've been getting better at it recently. I don't know if you saw Arrival a couple of years ago, where they had like
yes, I did.
Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner heading up the team, but you had a lot of scientists working there. Back in the day, it was really common to just bring in like one person as their go-to, like, this is what we're going to get our information from for everything.
Yeah, that trope. That trope's really bad.
I feel it's starting to die out. And I think we definitely give the point to the new Godzilla films on this, because as much as they don't really seem like real scientists, especially from some of the stuff that they're saying, that concept of having a team of people with different backgrounds and different sets of skills, I think that is much more representative of the team that you would get to work on a project or like a research proposal or a grant these days, or even just to go and work for a think tank.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about King of the Monsters is, and I forget the character's name, but the Chinese scientist. One of the twins, right? Yeah. Dr. Chin was her character's name. One of the things that I love about Dr. Chin is that she is not really a scientist necessarily, as more of a historian.
Yeah.
Who studies like the history and culture and mythology of these monsters.
Yeah, I think she's a social scientist. Like, she seems a bit like cultural anthropology, that sort of thing. Which absolutely people, especially when you're looking at this sort of thing, should get on board. Whether or not these monsters were actually around when there were functioning human societies is another thing. But if they were, then getting like a historical or a cultural anthropologist on board would be a great idea.
Yeah, exactly.
However, the reality of a scientist's life, I feel, is portrayed much better in the first one. Like, when you first meet Nyctatopoulos, he is just this ragtag hodgepodge of a man operating out of the back of this broke-ass van. Just, I mean, he's out there in the rain trying to get samples despite the fact that the weather is miserable. He's probably ecstatic because I think in 1998, that was what, maybe 13, 14 years after the Chernobyl disaster? I think they would have just been letting scientists in at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's clearly broke. Like, he's not doing a great job of keeping all his equipment together. He's got no idea why he's being called out. I reckon he's probably riddled with imposter syndrome. Like, he's... As opposed to all these like really clean-cut, well-paid people who are just standing around having, you know, conversations in front of like the military, like the military people are going to understand everything they say. It's just...
Right, yeah.
Yeah. I definitely buy Nyctatopoulos as a scientist more.
Right, yeah. And this idea that he's not well paid, like you said, his equipment's falling apart. It's like, yeah, because he's a guy who's studying earthworms. Nobody's going, even if it is for Chernobyl and like trying to understand radiation levels and stuff, you're not going to get a grant as easily for a guy who's going out and studying worms as you would for other things.
Your budget for that, like, and he's an American too, like, who's funding that? Like, there are so many European scientists who will be able to do that sort of stuff for a lot cheaper. Like, I don't know, maybe the Americans are getting in on like a really good radioactive site, but. Look, it just, yeah.
It does seem more realistic.
Yeah. And just the way that everything's kind of just hobbled together and he's constantly, like, overwhelmed by everything that's going on around him, I think that makes a lot more sense than these people who see a giant moth appear out of nowhere and are like, oh, yeah, sure. So I kind of think we have to give the point here to the old ones.
After 14 years of graduate school, Farnsworth settled into the glamorous life of a scientist. Fast cars, trendy night spots, beautiful women. The professor designed them all, working out of his tiny one-room apartment.
I think a lot of it goes back to the fact, with that particular trope, a lot of it goes to the fact that Monarch is supposed to be decades old at the point of King of the Monsters. Like, we see in... Skull Island, Kong Skull Island, that they already existed, Monarch already existed in the 70s.
Yeah.
When it comes to King of the Monsters, it's supposed to be, oh, well, here's this well-funded organization that's very well put together, everybody knows what they're doing, they've been studying these monsters for decades, they know all of the tricks and everything. I still find it very strange that a scientific organization like Monarch has this humongous underwater base like they do. It's just like, what are they doing?
Yeah. I guess they've got the military around them, and there's one thing learnt over the past 60 years is that America's military budget is somehow inexhaustible, so...
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's what I don't understand, because at the beginning of the film, at the hearing that they're having with Sarazawa and all of them, they're arguing that Monarch should be put under military control. And it's like, but the military's already there helping Monarch.
Yeah.
It seems like the military has a lot of control over Monarch anyway.
I kind of assume from the first film that they were a secret government organization. But you get the impression from the second one that they're kind of like some private think tank. Mm-hmm.
Monarch is one of those things that I'm sure people who have delved into the comic books and into the novelizations and everything can correct me on, but Monarch just doesn't seem like it's well...
Yeah.
Put together an idea. Like, the idea is good, but like it's not fully realized, because it just, there's a lot of contradictions there.
And the way that the scientists are just like spouting all these ridiculous ideas, and with not a shred of uncertainty, or like there's no like, hey, maybe you could be doing this, they're all just like, oh yeah, Mothra and Godzilla, there's a symbiotic relationship there. Nobody's being like, I mean, can we say that? We've got a sample size of one here.
We now return to Carl Sagan's Cosmos, edited for Rednecks.
I'm Carl Sagan. Just how old is our planet? Scientists believe it's
hundreds and hundreds of years old.
Scientists have determined that the universe was created by a
God.
Big Bang.
Let's move on to that then, because in both films, Nick Titopoulos and then the King of the Monsters gang, they are just pulling these random assumptions out of nowhere. I mean, and this is why I kind of have to fault him. Nick Titopoulos brings out a human pregnancy test for this enormous lizard. Now, I checked because there is a line in the movie where he's like, look, these tests weren't built for this, but fundamentally they test for the same sort of hormones. Not true at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have to build special, like, primate testing kits, because human testing, pregnancy testing kits a lot of the time don't work on other primates. So Dave is our veterinarian co-host. What he was saying is that he got stuck into this after I asked him last night. He was reading a thread from amateur reptile keepers about using human pregnancy tests from the dollar store to check if their reptiles are pregnant.
Uh-huh.
One guy claims it's accurate because his male reptile peed on it and it's negative. A smarter individual then responded that it would also be negative if he just peed on it himself. And then a long argument started about how the chemicals the government and corporations have fed them could alter their urine to give positive results.
Wow.
Fun times in the USA. But there are no urine tests available at the moment to check a dog's pregnancy. So pregnancy tests just from one mammal to the other. Testing for different hormones. In a reptile, it's going to be completely different. And the fact that he also just says, when they find out that he's pregnant, and they're like, oh, it must be like the earthworms. No, dude, that's not like a valid comparison to make.
Right, yeah. Well, what gets me is, why would you jump to the assumption that, this is a male, because they haven't really, as far as I know, they didn't do any tests to show what gender it was. Yeah. They just assumed it was male. And why would you assume it reproduces asexually? There might be another one out there. Yeah. This one evaded, like, being discovered for a long time. There might be another one out there.
They automatically assume, which it turns out to be, you know, a fair assumption, that it's one of a kind because of, you know, radiation testing or whatever. But if it's one of a kind, why was it not spotted growing up, you know? Was it just in the...
Right.
Oh, sorry, I get a bit worked up. However, even the fact that he's comparing earthworms to large reptiles, like, I can understand why they brought in someone who's an expert on radiation, because they've found traces of radiation on, like, you know, the things that he's attacking, all that sort of stuff. But the fact that he just sees something and he's like, oh, it must be what's happening with my earthworms. I mean, that's...
Mm-hmm.
You're going across phyla there. Yeah, it's like from an annelid, which is like the phylum that the earthworms come under, to a reptile. It's not... We barely have an understanding. Well, we're starting to get a bit more of an understanding of how radiation is affecting, you know, some of the creatures that live in Chernobyl. So, looking at kind of freshwater life, algae, that sort of stuff. We're getting an understanding of that now because, you know, more and more scientists are allowed in there. But surely there was someone who had, I guess there's not too many reptiles in the Ukraine anyway, but my God, there's, yeah. But anyway.
I was going to say, I would still give the point to him, to G98 on that front more than King of the Monsters, because at least it's just Nick Titopoulos who's making this leap.
Oh, good.
Because
point.
No one else really believes him at first. And it's like, well, yeah, he's the worm guy. You bring him in to be the worm expert who's expert on, you know, the radiation and mutation. And so he's, of course, he's going to make maybe those kinds of leaps of like, well, if I'm here for this reason, maybe it is the same thing as my earthworms. Whereas in King of the Monsters, everyone makes those leaps like that.
And they're all just feeding each other as well. It's crazy. They're like, one of them's like, well, maybe it came from outer space because she's looked at like a couple of texts which suggest an invader. But I mean, A, if you have a culture living on an island and like a new creature arrives, why would you assume that it's come from outer space? I mean, I don't know. Maybe they didn't have a concept of, you know, other continents or land masses. But the fact that a cultural or historical or whatever she is anthropologist looks at that and think, oh, it's an alien. Like, it's literally an alien. It's come from another planet. And that you have three or four biologists and ecologists in the room who just go with it. Oh, my God.
I rewatched that scene earlier today, and it says, why wasn't he affected by the oxygen destroyer? And they say, well, maybe it has something to do with him regrowing his head.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that just defies all natural laws. But you're living in a world with giant mutos and Godzilla and Rodan and all these other things. I think the natural laws are out the window to begin with. So Ghidorah regrowing his head is not much stranger than everything else that's going on.
I mean, he's got three heads to start off with.
Yeah, so why would that immediately tell you alien, it's gotta be an alien.
And what else is it? The Kyle, there's a scene where Kyle Chandler's like, this animal, they're coming to either fight, feed, or something else. And it's heavily implied that he's going to say fuck. Interspecies mating is a thing. That's how you get hybrids, like, you know, mules or ligers. That's how we got the red wolves in the US. But why would you see a pterodactyl and a three-headed monster and just assume that they're going to be able to reproduce?
Or maybe an astronaut. Yeah. I'd be the first motherfucker to see a new galaxy or find a new alien life form and fuck it. And people be like, there he goes. Homeboy fucked a Martian once.
Oh, I mean, look, normally when I'm watching films, I don't get bothered by this stuff. I go back and I watch them through the lens of the whole Cinematica Animalia thing later on because I just kind of want to enjoy the movie. Mm-hmm. But even when I was watching this in the cinema, I'm just sitting there thinking, where is this coming from? Where did you get your degree?
Yeah. That's one of the things that I both like and also dislike just from me. I mean, I know it's more frustrating for you who knows a lot more about the science side of things. But one of the things that I think is interesting about King of the Monsters is they try to explain giant monsters in the universe and in the world. Whereas if you go back to like classic giant monster movies from Japan, a lot of these, you know, the ones that these monsters are from, they do little explanations of them, but they don't go into this whole like, how does it apply to the natural order of things, how does it fit into our, you know, our web of life that we have in on this planet and everything. It's like they don't try to do all that. It's just a giant monster.
As much as I hate to say it, the origin and the generally ecological science in Godzilla 98 is just, it's better because A, you don't have to worry about the size because it's a one-off mutation, and B, they don't go any further than that. Nick Titopoulos goes a bit further than that at times, but the constant science that they're trying, like the reality that they're trying to inject into this film, I don't know if it needs it. But I guess, you know, you are following around a scientific organization as your point of view in the second film anyway.
Right. And I would really like for in Godzilla versus King Kong, which is supposed to be coming out at some point, who knows when, that they just completely undo all of that and say, oh, everything that we understood about these monsters and everything we've been saying about these monsters is not true. And they're just monsters. just completely wipe the slate clean and go from just start over. I mean, just if these were mythological beings and gods and titans, that would be more interesting than if they were, than their explanation of, oh, this is an animal that lived in a time when there was more radiation on Earth and everything was bigger and all that. Yeah, you know, it's so overdone. There's no reason for it.
So yeah, we're 3-1 to G98 at this point.
Before there was time, before there was anything, there was nothing. And before there was nothing, there were monsters.
But the last one is, and I think on this, I don't know if I've subconsciously done this deliberately, but the fact that in the new Godzilla films, I know they give the excuse of they feed off radiation, but you never see anything feeding apart from that one scene with the Muto, like literally just eating a nuclear weapon. I don't know why, but it really bothers me, the fact that you never see like these big monsters like just chowing down, because they are going to need massive amounts of food. Dave's always said that the fact, like at the end of that first Godzilla film, it'd be a fucking nightmare for people who were standing around, because it'd just be Godzilla standing there eating the Muto carcasses for like a week. He's not leaving back into the sea. Mm-hmm. He's probably going to leave, he's probably going to eat them, have a big sleep, and then take off. But do you think there's any effective way that that can be worked into these films? Like, would you want to see, like, Godzilla defeat Ghidorah and then just feast on his carcass for a week?
Well, that's the thing is, I think it goes back to the classic giant monster movies. You don't see any of the monsters really eating anything. Yeah. The original Godzilla doesn't really eat anything. The original Ghidorah doesn't really eat anything. Mothra doesn't. It's just, you know, it goes back to that idea of they're just giant monsters. They're not animals. They're not doing, you know, they're just giant monsters, and we just don't care what they're eating or what they're doing, where their waste is going. But I totally understand where, if you're trying to make these monsters seem more like real life animals, the more you do that, the more questions come up. Well, if they are real life animals, then they have to do real life animal things. Yeah. So how are they doing that?
we spoke briefly about in the last time I was on your podcast about King Kong taking a whiz.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Godzilla, I mean, a lot of reptiles combine kind of the uric acid and the urine. I would not want to be around Godzilla if that happens, especially like the more recent versions. I guess because in Godzilla 98, you see that. You see him feasting on the fish. And maybe the newer films just saw that and thought, look, we want to stay away from that whole iconic scene where Matthew Broderick just looks to the army colonel and says, that's a lot of fish.
Yeah.
Such a blank, pointless, look, it doesn't matter. But there is that aspect of realism to it whereby, yeah, this guy needs to eat. And shoals of fish are what, like, large marine reptiles and marine mammals have always been eating. Like, that's what they've been feasting on, larger organisms. And so you give them a massive stack of fish, yeah, that's probably going to lure them out. Having said that, it doesn't really make for an entertaining scene or funny jokes, or it's not even that suspenseful.
But the thing is, that scene, it's one of the better scenes in that movie because, not because of Matthew Broderick. Matthew Broderick, again, there's no personality there to latch onto. But as far as the creature, as far as Godzilla is concerned, it adds that realism to it, but also adds a little bit of connection that you have as an audience member. Hey, this is just an animal that wants to eat. And it's not, you know, I mean, all of us have, you know, watched birds go for bird feeders, or, you know, a squirrel go over and pick up something off the ground or something like that. And this is just a large animal that's coming in and it just wants to eat a little bit of food and then take off. And so I think that adds to the tragic nature of the movie, or at least what the movie was trying to do.
Yeah,
didn't really do a good job at it, of making you feel for the monster and make you feel bad for the monster when it dies. You don't really get that because the last scene of the movie, or when they kill the monster, everybody's celebrating. And I don't think, you know, that's not going to happen in the real world. It's like, hey, we killed the only creature of this species. Yay. Like, no.
No, yeah. It's, I don't know. Yeah, because it's one of those things where I guess it has to be termed an invasive species at that point. Because, I mean, it's not from around there and it's causing some severe damage to human health and economics as well. But I don't, it's just...
Right.
Yeah, I don't know how you would insert that well into this new universe anyway.
Yeah, I don't think you could. I really don't think you could. I think they should just move on with it.
Yeah, go back to find a more charismatic military dude to tell it from the perspective of. But speaking of that scientist, like, can you think of a good example of a more realistic scientist in a movie? Someone who comes along and is just this anxiety-ridden... pressed for time, broadcast, like, ramshackle human being.
Oh, this is bad. This is really bad. You're working, you slave, and you steal just enough for a sweet lick of that shiny brass ring. Don't I get a lick? Doesn't Gil get a lick?
All right, well, look, we're at the tail end of the episode, and I hate to say it, but yeah, we've given a 4-1 victory in terms of our representation of science life to Godzilla 98. I'm very sorry to the kaiju groupies out there who are unhappy with the result, but what can I say? We're not here for the quality of the films. So every week here we do a bit of a versus scenario. We try to throw some of these monsters into amusing situations. Now we've got a bit of precedent to go on this week because what we wanted to do was pit the two against each other. Now obviously in a normal battle, one of them's like 50 times the size of the other. So we wanted to bring Godzilla, King of the Monsters, down and bring G98 up, so they're about the same size. And Trev, you were saying earlier, this has actually happened before.
Yeah. Well, not with the legendary Godzilla, but with the original Toho Godzilla in Final Wars, which is a Godzilla movie from 2004. They in that movie, the classic Toho Japanese Godzilla is fighting every monster that you could think of, and one of the monsters that shows up is the G98 American
Zilla,
one.
They call
and
him, right?
They call him Zilla. And he makes quick work of him and destroys the Sydney Opera House in the process.
Smashes it to pieces. Yeah.
Yeah. So there is precedent.
Yeah, so because obviously the Zilla 98 is a lot more agile. Like, he's moving a lot faster. He doesn't have any atomic breath to speak of, I don't think.
No, not the one that we get in the movie does not have an atomic breath. But in the cartoon, the progeny, the son of that Godzilla, does have an atomic breath.
Okay.
And they explain that as, like, a spontaneous mutation that the original one didn't have, and then this one mutated even more. But
this is, I actually think it's going to be a lot closer, because one of the really noticeable things about Godzilla 98 is the size of his jaw and the fact that he's clearly got like a lot of spinal plates around there. The more surface area you have on bones, it's generally better for muscle attachment. The way his jaw's structured, he's going to have a really powerful bite strength, whereas Godzilla, King of the Monsters, I don't want to body shame anyone, but he's got a real, real pinhead. Like, he's got a tiny little head on top of a real chunky body.
Yep.
If Godzilla 98 gets his jaws around the other one, he's in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
As soon as he gets his, like, jaws around something, he's not letting go. And this is kind of a trope that comes up in a lot of things as well. You remember that fight between the King Kong and the Varanosaurus Rex or whatever it is?
The V-Rex.
Yeah. That, like, you know when a couple of times Kong gets his arm stuck in their mouths? He's Kong's fucked at that point. The jaw strength on those things was incredible. I don't care how thick Kong's skin is. He's in serious trouble as soon as that bite goes down.
And in the Godzilla movies, in the, you know, King of the Monsters and 2014, you don't see Godzilla using his jaws and his mouth very much.
He does a little bit in King of the Monsters when he sinks his teeth into one of Ghidorah's heads and then rips the head off.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, he does do that. But he does a lot more with his tail and with his, you know, like the more powerful parts of his body, which makes sense. So yeah, I'm completely with you on that one, that if G98, if they were of a similar size and G98 got up close and latched onto Legendary Godzilla's throat, he would just lock his jaw on that throat and just not let go. Yeah, it's not as simple as people might think of, the Godzilla 2014 or King of the Monsters, that he would just use his atomic breath. I'm like, no, this G98's very agile. And if he gets in close and he's got longer arms and looks like sharper claws on those long fingers, so he could really do some damage on Legendary.
I think it's really going to be a case of like whether he's familiar with this rival species. Like, does he know that he has to be a bit wary and keep his distance? Because if he rushes in, then he's going to get either blasted pretty quickly or just smashed. Because that tail on Godzilla, the King of the Monsters, is a lot more powerful. That was one of my favorite bits of the 2014 Godzilla movies, when he smashes the male Muto into the building. That was fantastic.
Yeah.
Then, I mean, that's going to break some ribs. Like, I don't know if anybody remembers Walking with Dinosaurs, when the T-Rex gets into the big fight with the Ankylosaurus, the Kenneth Branagh narrated thing in the day. That'll crack a rib. Like, that's gonna kill you. If he doesn't die in the battle, then it's probably going to die, a week later just from not being able to hunt properly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have an answer to this one. I want to give it to Godzilla King of the Monsters just because, we were so harsh on it for the rest of the episode, but
it's not an easy battle. And in fact, anybody who's familiar with the Godzilla comic books, Zilla, the G98 one, does show up in there, and he is a formidable enemy and formidable fighter in that, because in the comic books they really do a lot with his agility and his speed and everything. So. Yeah, it's not an easy fight.
I think it'd be a lot of fun, but
yeah.
I do think that in this case, Godzilla King of the Monsters would probably win, purely because Zilla 98 would be just completely naive and would just go straight for the throat and get clocked with a tail or some atomic breath. And then, look, I think if their meetups were a common thing, then it'd be a different story. But look, if it's just, they come across each other for the first time, then Godzilla 98 is probably going to rush in and get his ass handed to him.
Yeah.
The arrogance of man is thinking nature is in their control, and not the other way around. Let them fight.
Are you sure there's nothing we can do?
Let them fight.
Maybe nuke the creatures before they reach a major city?
Let them fight.
Maybe power down the facilities these monsters feed off of?
Let them fight.
You just want to see giant monsters fight, don't you?
Let them fight.
That's it for this week. Look, if you really like this episode, give us a like in app if you're on the Apple Podcasts or whatever the Android version is. Give us a review. It really helps. Go over to Trevor and Michael's podcast, Kaiju Weekly. Give them a shot as well. They've got a brand spanking new logo, which, by the way, love it.
Michael is great at the graphic designing, so yeah.
That's all for now. We'll be back next week. Adam's partner, Libby, is going to come on, and they're going to discuss Deep Blue Sea and Piranha 3D, which I'm really looking forward to hearing. So that's either coming up in 1 week or 2 weeks. So yeah, I should say thanks to Trav for coming on again.
No problem. I had a lot of fun.
Yes. All right. Well, thanks for coming on, and we might see you again in the future. Until next time, the monsters aren't real, but the science is. Sort of. Not very much in these films, to be honest.
We know where he came from. We know how big he is.
His situation has become more complicated.
But our problems just multiplied.
He's pregnant.
What is this, the virgin lizard?
You've got to find that nest before it's too late.
Otherwise, up to a dozen are gonna be born. Think of it.
Doesn't he need a mate?
Not if he reproduces asexually.
Where's the fun in that?
Godzilla.